KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show Jeremy Malcolm of Consumer International. Jeremy is someone that I met recently, actually, at a conference in American University involving the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the largely secret agreement being negotiated by a variety of countries that purports to deal with piracy issues in intellectual property, but could be dealing with anything because we simply don't know what's going on. We're going to be discussing the transparency and accountability issues with Jeremy today, as well as the broader discussion with regard to what Consumers International is and the kind of projects that they're currently working on. ACTA has been a topic, and we'll use that acronym throughout the show, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA, which is currently under negotiation, has been a topic of previous shows on Hearsay Culture, most recently with Professor Michael Geist, who has taken the lead, I think, among scholars in focusing people's attention on this issue. Jeremy has concerns that are similar to mine, as well as Michael's, with respect to the transparency issues, and so we will be discussing those at length. Jeremy did a presentation at the conference that I attended where he compared the ACTA regime in terms of how the negotiations are going from a structural standpoint with how negotiations have been done in other international treaties and agreements, and basically compared the two and found that ACTA has been far less transparent and accountable than all previous major negotiations, not only in intellectual property, I think, but in other regimes like environmental law and internet governance. So we're going to work through some of that material today. And in addition, discuss the current status of ACTA, because ACTA recently went through a round of negotiations in Wellington, New Zealand, and Jeremy will be able to update us a little bit on where we are. By way of background, Jeremy is an information technology and intellectual property lawyer and an IT consultant. He is admitted to the Supreme Court of Western Australia, among other courts. He did his PhD in law at Murdoch University in 2008, and he focused on the Internet Governance Forum, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Currently, he is a project manager for Consumer International in its Asia-Pacific office, and he is joining us today by Skype from his home in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Jeremy, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
And I appreciate also, given the time difference, that you are doing this almost at night, really, your time. So thanks again. Jeremy, let's start off the discussion with a question I ask really most of my guests, which is a bit more about your background. How did you become interested in the issues that we're going to be discussing today?
Well, as you introduced me, I began as a lawyer, and for the first 5 or so years of my career, I was working in a medium-sized law firm, trying to do as much of the technology-related work as I could, because that was what interested me. And after a while, I decided that I was so interested by this that I wanted to start my own firm specializing in IT and IP law, and simultaneously an IT consultancy where I could actually get my hands dirty and do some some coding, some hacking, that sort of thing. So I did that for the next 5 years or so. And in the course of that, I became involved with some of the community organizations that were working in the internet space in Australia, because, of course, I was living in Australia then rather than Malaysia. That included the local chapter of the Internet Society, the Western Australian Internet Association, which was, a state equivalent to the Internet Society, the local Linux Users Group, the Australian Public Access Network Association, which was sort of a cooperative. It was like an internet provider, but it operated on a non-commercial cooperative basis. Anyway, Electronic Frontiers Australia as well, which is the Australian equivalent of the EFF, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. So with all of these involvements at a community level, I decided that it was probably time for me to take a break from lawyering as such and go into more of a public interest role, particularly because, as any lawyers will know, any practicing lawyers will know, it sometimes can be difficult when you're forced to take instructions from clients who you are philosophically opposed to. And as an IP lawyer in particular, most of the instructions that you receive are from copyright owners, trademark owners, or patent owners trying to enforce their rights against others and, in some cases, against individuals, consumers. And so this, although it's an important job, it didn't sit so well for me after several years of doing it. So I decided that I would take a break from practicing in that area and really start working for the other side, working for consumers to uphold their interests in intellectual property rights, or rather their interests in access to knowledge, as we call it. So that was what caused me to move over to Consumers International, which is a global federation of consumer groups. And it started up a program on access to knowledge in 2008, which is the year when I joined. And so I've been managing that for the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned your background there, Jeremy, because I have a similar background in that I practiced law in New York, representing, at least for a part of my time practicing in New York, various entertainment industry clients, and then ultimately, after a few years, went over to Stanford, working for Larry Lessig and Jennifer Granick, doing some of the very work that the entertainment industry opposes with respect to copyright issues. And so I can certainly sympathize with your suggestions, although, and I'm not suggesting you're saying this, but it wasn't a totally right and wrong situation, in that I felt the entertainment industry was always wrong and the other side was always right, but I was definitely much more sympathetic ultimately on the intellectual property law issues to people like Lessig and EFF and others that dealt with these issues. So it's an interesting background. And I guess the follow-up question I have for you is, how have you found being on the other side, as it were?
Well, it hasn't been that dramatic a change, because I have, when I was practicing as a lawyer, I did have clients, as you say, on both sides. It was never entirely one way. I was working for some small business clients, some end users, as well as the corporate clients. Also for Linux Australia, which was the local, or the Australian, I guess, equivalent of Linux International, I suppose. In one interesting case, I had a client who was sued for complaining about spam. So in that case, I took that one on pro bono, but that was quite a high-profile case where the client actually was sued for interfering with the business of a spammer because he reported the spammer to an internet block list. So there were some fun cases like that. And I've tried to stay in touch with some of my old clients since I've been in this new role. But it is good that I don't have to rely for my bread and butter on some of the less fulfilling work that I used to have to do. So I'm quite happy here at Consumers International because I can pretty much believe in everything I do, which makes a nice change.
It is a nice thing. There are a lot of budding lawyers that listen to the show. I'm not speaking of my students particularly, although they may be listening, but just generally, and it's always interesting to hear that perspective on the practice of law. You started to mention a bit about Consumers International, but for those listeners that aren't familiar, can you discuss it in a bit more detail? Where is it located? Obviously, the name reflects where it's located, but what are the primary focuses of Consumers International, and what is its structure?
Well, we have a head office in London, and we have regional offices in Johannesburg and Kuala Lumpur and Santiago in Chile. And the regional offices are sort of semi-independent. They pursue some projects on a regional level, but the organization as a whole is directed by a board which is composed of the leaders of consumer organizations around the world, and they'll decide the overall policies and strategies that we should adopt on behalf of the consumer movement. So we have about 220 member organizations in about 115 countries. They include, for example, Consumers Union from the United States, Choice from Australia, Which from the UK, and various other. In some countries, we have several members. So in the US and the UK, we have several member organisations. And this year, in fact, we celebrate our 50th anniversary. So,
congratulations!
Yes, indeed. Tomorrow, as it so happens, tomorrow. I'm talking to you on the 7th of July. So right. The 8th of July is our 50th anniversary.
And so what is the organization doing to celebrate its 50th anniversary?
We've had a few events around the world. We had a global meeting on access to knowledge earlier in the year. And in conjunction with that, we had a 50th anniversary celebration day with our president, who currently comes from Kenya. He's the president of the Consumers Information Network of Kenya. And he flew over, and we had big cake cutting and so on. But apart from that, all of the different regions have been doing things on a regional level. We've got a publication that highlights some of our achievements over the last 50 years and so on. So if anyone's interested in finding out more about Consumers International, including the 50th anniversary events, you can go to our website, which is at www.consumersinternational.org. That's consumersinternational.org.
Excellent. Jeremy, with respect to turning our attention to technology issues, before we focus on ACTA specifically, and I appreciate you mentioning the day of the recording, because we are recording on the day that the show will air, if you could perhaps give an overview of the aside from ACTA, of the focuses of Consumers International with respect to technology and IP issues, that would be good, and then we can turn towards ACTA more specifically.
Sure. Well, as a general consumer organization, obviously, we have a much broader focus than just IP and access to knowledge. So other parts of the organization are dealing with things ranging from food security to product safety and sustainable consumption and so on. But in terms of the areas that are relevant to your listeners, the Access to Knowledge program is designed to uphold consumers' interests in, access to knowledge, which includes intellectual property rights, but is a bit broader. It includes also access to the means of producing and disseminating and accessing knowledge. So this can be communications networks like the internet and so on. Also, access to information in your local language, access to information that's culturally relevant. So it's much broader than just IP, but IP is quite central to the project, and particularly where we've started from. We've started off with a focus on copyright, and we're broadening that out as we go along. But the first few projects that we did since I came on board included a global survey of which countries in the world have the fairest copyright laws for consumers. In our first year, we surveyed 16 countries, and in our second year, we had 34 countries. And we've also done a global survey in about 25 countries of the barriers that consumers face in accessing copyright material, which may be copyright law or it may be other barriers that they face, like language or access to information and communication technologies. We've also done some focused research in a couple of countries on the effect of new copyright exceptions. For example, Israel in 2007 brought in a new fair use exception similar to what the USA has, and Australia brought in some new copyright exceptions that allow for time shifting, space shifting, and format shifting of copyright materials, such as moving music from a CD onto your iPod. In many countries of the world, and this might surprise some of your stateside listeners, that's illegal. You can't legally copy your own music from a CD, or rather, copy music from your own CD onto your iPod without breaking the law. So we're looking at what some countries have done to introduce new exceptions to cater for these sorts of uses. And so these are the kind of things that we've been looking at. And we hope to extend the project for another 2 years. We're in discussions with some funders at the moment, and we'll be doing some other interesting things, which I probably shouldn't discuss in too much detail until they're confirmed.
Fair enough. Well, it sounds like you've got plenty on your plate. And I am curious, one last question before we turn to Acton more specifically is, as I mentioned, and you mentioned, you're based in Malaysia. For listeners that aren't familiar with the Malaysian economy and legal structure with respect to IP and technology, perhaps you could mention why it is that Consumers International is based in Malaysia and what your experience has been, perhaps, dealing with these issues in Malaysia specifically, if you have.
Sure. Well, the position that I hold is a global position, so the project that I'm managing is global, despite the fact that we're based in Malaysia. However, Because I'm based here, I have taken some interest in the local scene, and there are some interesting points about Malaysia. One is that the government has got a very strong support for open source software, both within government and more broadly. They've got an ambition to make open source software use pervasive throughout government, throughout the public sector. So that's promising. On the other hand, they're also just reviewing their Copyright Act, and although I can't say too much about the changes that are planned, because they're not public yet, not all of them are public yet, some of them are good and some of them are bad. We are hoping to have more exceptions to copyright, such as the US-style fair use, but on the negative side, the government has publicly stated, so I'm not breaking any confidences here, but saying that they're wanting to go after individual consumers for the possession of copyright works, and this includes as possession of even one infringing copy. So it could be an infringing, you know, a pirate CD or a pirate DVD, but according to the letter of the new law, it could even be just an infringing file on your computer that could become a criminal offence. So, and the penalties are going to be significantly increased. So Malaysia has got, I guess like much of the world, it's got some really well-meaning politicians who are trying to do the right things for consumers, and at the same time there's also a very strong lobby from the media corporations that are trying to protect their own interests, and so sometimes that can skew the copyright balance away from consumers. So one of the things that Consumers International tries to do is to act as a watchdog for these sorts of moves by government and industry to make sure that the consumers' interests aren't forgotten about.
We're chatting with Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, I hadn't anticipated discussing this in a bit more detail, but perhaps if you'll indulge a few more questions on what's going on in Malaysia, that would be nice. And I promise Jeremy not to ask you a question that directly demands any confidential information. And of course, you have the option very easily to say I can't answer the question. But with that in mind, I'm curious. Open source for government is a growing movement. There's an organization here in the United States called Open Source for America that is pushing in a way that you seem to be suggesting Malaysia is acting. I'm curious to know what the impetus is for Malaysia to adopt, the Malaysian government to adopt open source. Where do you think that impetus, for where is that deriving?
Well, Malaysia is a developing country. It's therefore partly a financial imperative because it's also a country in which, from not so much within government, but at a level of consumers, there's endemic piracy. Pirated software is very readily available from almost anywhere. And simply because the consumers don't have the level of income that they have in developed countries, they're really forced into resorting to use of pirated software. But this is not a good thing. I mean, Consumers International doesn't support piracy. Certainly, the industry doesn't support piracy, and neither does the government. And so I guess open source is a way of sidestepping that whole problem. The government's actually had 8 objectives, of which that's only one. The other objectives of this program include increasing freedom of choice in software usage, increasing interoperability, trying to grow the local ICT industry, because whereas proprietary software companies from Malaysia don't have much of a presence elsewhere in the world, there are Malaysian developers who do contribute significantly to open source development. And that can actually attract business to Malaysia for support of open source. And I won't go through all of the other objectives of this program, but one of them that I'll close with is reducing the digital divide. So I guess that goes back to the fact that Malaysia is a developing country, and the aim is to, leapfrog up to the level of the more developed countries through the use of open source software, where at the moment the digital divide precludes Malaysia from operating at that same level.
And presumably, and last point on Malaysia before turning it active, Malaysia is under pressure, as are many countries, from U.S. and certainly Western-based entertainment industry that are demanding countries like Malaysia and others to crack down on piracy. So I'm sure underlying a lot of what's going on is perhaps some of that pressure anyway.
I've already mentioned how even possession of a single infringing item is going to become criminal in Malaysia, and the penalties are also being increased. There's a proposal, which I think is on the public record, to make the landlords of premises liable for piracy that occurs in their tenants' premises. So if a shopping centre owner has a pirated DVD shop, then the owner of the shopping centre would become liable. Also, criminalisation of camcording in movie theatres. All of these things are from the wish list of the movie industry, and we see this in their submissions to the United States Special 301 report. The Special 301 report, I'm not sure if it's been mentioned on your show before, but that's an annual report that the United States Trade Representative puts out, rating other countries around the world according to how strongly they protect IP rights of US IP holders. And in many ways, Consumers International's own IP watch list is designed as the converse of that 301 report. We're looking at countries around the world based on how fair their IP laws are for consumers. So part of our work is really designed to offset the the United States Special 301.
Well, you've opened up that door as well, Jeremy. So I'll ask you, perhaps you have this data at your fingertips. What countries do you find are the fairest as far as IP law goes currently?
Well, the last 2 years have seen India at the top, interestingly, and India has just also introduced a new amendment to its copyright law, which is with regard to DRM, or digital rights management. Now, India and Malaysia is in the same position. They're not actually signatories to the treaty that requires the protection of DRM. For those who aren't familiar with it, this treaty, the WIPO Copyright Treaty, basically makes it illegal for you to bypass a copyright protection mechanism in a digital artifact that you buy. So it might be a software CD that's got a copy protection mechanism. It might be a DVD that's got the DVD encryption standard, CSS, or it might be a downloaded video that you might buy from something like the Apple iTunes store. If you bypass those copyright protection mechanisms, in many countries you're breaking the law. And what India has done, and it remains at the top of the most friendly countries, is it has passed a very narrow amendment protecting DRM so that it doesn't make it illegal for consumers to bypass these digital locks for purposes that qualify as fair use or fair dealing. So if you're bypassing a digital lock because you want to use the product for educational purposes or for personal use or for making backup copies or for library use, that's perfectly legal in India. And so we think that's a good model that other countries should follow. And amongst the other countries that came out tops this year, were Israel, which, as I mentioned earlier, has recently introduced a fair use exception similar to the US. The US itself is also amongst the most friendly countries. Now, that's surprising in a way because so much of my work is about criticizing US policy, but that's because the US foreign policy on IP is actually much more stringent than its domestic policy. Because at a domestic level, the USA has freedom of expression guaranteed in its constitution. It has a broad fair use exception. It has a variety of safeguards that don't exist in other countries. So when the US is actually pushing the strictest parts of its IP law onto other countries, it's not also pushing on these safeguards, such as fair use. So it ends up that other countries will adopt a 70-year copyright term and will adopt protection for DRM and adopt all of these, anti-camcording in movie theatres and so on, all of these harsh things from US law, but they won't adopt the safeguards. And that's really why the US comes out so much better than many of the other countries that we looked at. In our first year, the United Kingdom was actually last on our list of countries. Hmm. This year, the United Kingdom is third last, and the last is Chile. So I won't go through the list of all of them, but it's really interesting. And if people would like to see the whole list, they can go to our A2K sub-site, which is a2knetwork.org. That's a2knetwork.org, and look for the link to the watch list, which has got this list of 34 countries.
We're chatting with Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International and KZSU FM Hearsay Culture. For those that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can click on, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the station. Jeremy, your last point with regard to the U.S. having fairer domestic IP laws than those that the U.S. demands from the rest of the world is an interesting insight, and I think a good transitional statement into our discussion of ACTA, because it appears from what's been publicly put out there, and I say that because these are both formal and informal sources of information. The U.S. seems to be, appears to be the country that is pushing most heavily to keep ACTA negotiations largely secret, and seems also to be a country, from what has been leaked in terms of the drafts, that's pushing hardest for, on issues like penalties. For those that aren't familiar, and like I said, we have had Michael Geist on the show previously, you know, putting aside the basics, which I mentioned in the introduction, that ACTA is currently being negotiated amongst a variety of countries to deal broadly with IP piracy issues, and because it's under negotiation, it is not yet the law, although it appears that ACTA in one form or another will ultimately become an agreement that with which many countries have to grapple. Perhaps you could update the listeners on the most recent round of negotiations in Wellington, New Zealand. What happened there?
Well, the official outcome of any of the rounds of negotiations is a very terse document that we get from the negotiating parties that just says, these are the issues that were discussed, such as border measures and the internet chapter of the agreement and so on. And it really gives you very little to go on. We scored a bit of a win when the negotiating text was released, admittedly anonymized, so that we didn't get comments from particular countries, but we did get a version of the negotiating text released to the public after the next to most recent negotiations. It was not really much of a gift because we already had a leaked version of the text, which was quite similar to the officially released version. Since then, it seems that there's been a stepping back from even that level of transparency because following the most recent negotiations, we haven't seen another release of the text. Again, we know that there's one country holding out on the others. If the text is to be released, all the countries have to agree. And we have one country holding out on us now. We may speculate that it might be the U.S., but we know for sure that the U.S. was one of the countries that held up the release of the text before. So really, despite the public outcry and despite the leaks and despite the level of anger out there in the community, it seems the negotiators still haven't learnt their lesson and are still hoping that they can push this through for completion in the year 2010 with a minimum level of public oversight and a minimum discussion in the public domain of the impact of the provisions.
Now, this is quite alarming because we're not talking about a minor negotiation that will have minimal impact on the countries to whom who are negotiating it. This is a major treaty that, from what we can tell from the leaked information, appears to radically, in some cases, change domestic laws. With that in mind, unfortunately, a primary focus has been, rather than the substance of the law, the issue of getting the information in the first place. And perhaps this is intentional as well, to keep people's eye off the ball, both by not releasing information and by forcing this discussion. Your concern, or I should ask, what is your primary concern? And I say that asking you in your capacity as a member of Consumers International about the lack of transparency. Why should consumers, not only in the United States but internationally, be concerned about how ACTA has been handled?
Well, I don't want to duplicate too much what Michael Geist has said on your show, and so I'm going to take a slightly different tack to this, because I think that the lack of transparency in the negotiations is very important, but that we should even look beyond that and think about what will be the transparency and the accountability and the openness of the of ACTA after it comes into law, because they're trying to set up an ACTA, a separate institution for ACTA. Basically, there's a chapter on institutional matters within the ACTA text, which will set up a governing council. And we have to look at what public access to this council will be, what public access to the recommendations that it produces, to its negotiation venue, to future amendments to the ACTA agreement. Are we going to have a similar trouble gaining access to ACTA after it's been enacted as during its original negotiations? I think we have to fear the worst based on the experience we've had so far, that once ACTA is in place, things are not going to get easier. Things are going to get harder for us. And so the presentation that I gave at the seminar that you mentioned was really looking at not only the level of transparency and public access to the negotiations of ACTA, but also what comes after that. And so my concern is not that between now and the end of 2010 we're going to have limited access to ACTA. My concern is that from 2010 until who knows when, we're going to have limited access. And for me, that's even more frightening than the fact that we've been excluded from the negotiations so far.
Right, and I hear that, and I appreciate not wanting to duplicate content. Although it's interesting to note that at the conference, Professor Geist, somewhat tongue in cheek, but talked about transparency as an issue that was not clearly off the table, but that he felt was being resolved. And then, as you mentioned, most recently, this round of negotiations seems to, and the more recent rounds of negotiations have taken a step back from it. This institution that ACTA envisions, what do we know about it? To the extent we know anything, what are its broad contours? What is it purported to be about, and what will it in fact be doing, to the extent that we can tell?
Well, I'll move to that in a second, but just to go to your previous point about how Michael Geister suggested at the seminar that we both attended that maybe the transparency battle was over. This was before the latest negotiation round, because since the New Zealand negotiations, we've had another set of negotiations in Lucerne in Switzerland, and it was after the Lucerne negotiations that they decided not to release another version of the text. So Professor Geist's confidence was based on the positive outcome of the New Zealand negotiations, when we did get a text, but we haven't received a text from Lucerne. So I think the transparency is clearly going back again. But to go to your question about what is the institution that is being set up for ACTA, well, we don't know exactly, but we do know that there will be what will be called either an oversight committee or a steering committee, and that this committee will have the right to further elaborate the treaty, in other words, to propose amendments to the treaty. It will have the ability to make decisions about compliance with the treaty. It may not have an enforcement mechanism in quite the same way as the World Trade Organization. For those who don't know, the World Trade Organization, or the WTO, can authorize the use of trade sanctions against member countries that don't comply. So the TRIPS agreement, which is a WTO agreement, sets standards for IP, and if a country doesn't follow those standards, then they can be penalized through trade sanctions on their, say, their agricultural exports or whatever. There probably won't be quite the same hard enforcement within ACTA, but we are confident that there will be soft enforcement through a variety of channels. For example, we've already spoken about the US Special 301 report. At the moment, the Special 301 report is putting forth standards for global IP protection that are in excess of what the TRIPS agreement requires. For example, the TRIPS agreement requires a 50-year term of copyright protection, and the USTR has been saying that really the new global norm is 70 years. Now, this doesn't actually come from any plurilateral agreement on copyright. It comes mainly from free trade agreements that the US and the EU have negotiated with their trading partners and from US and EU law. So if ACTA is agreed between a small number of developing countries, we can see very clearly that this will be used to show the grounds for a new higher bar of enforcement of IP rights, not only amongst those developing countries, but to developing countries as well. And so, although it's not enforceable directly, it will be enforced through mechanisms such as the 301 report, through future free trade agreements that the US and EU and other developed countries conclude with their trading partners. In fact, many of these free trade agreements already have the ACTA-style provisions in them. But once we have a plurilateral agreement in the form of ACTA, it's just going to lend further weight to that. So it's going to be harder for other countries, and particularly developing countries, to resist the imposition of these terms in their trade agreements.
We're chatting. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, that's a suitable time to head back.
That's what I was. You know, after doing a show, while I hope to usually get the right moment to jump in. Sometimes I miss. We're chatting with Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International on KZSU FM and Hearsay Culture. Jeremy, we have about 10 minutes left, and I do want to spend time on more specifically on what you discussed at the conference. You compared your organization compared the transparency issues with regard to ACTA with several other regimes, both the IP regimes and non-intellectual property law regimes, have basically found that ACTA is far less transparent across the board than these other regimes, some of which in the IP realm have not been particularly transparent to begin with. So perhaps you could give the broad strokes there. What ultimately did your study find with respect to the transparency as compared to these other regimes?
Okay, well, I was looking at what are the best practices for both transparency and also public participation. In other words, public input into international forum. And I found that there are two global governance regimes in which there are actually formal standards for transparency and public participation. And these are the environmental law regime and the internet governance regime. And in the IP regime, there are no formal standards, as you sort of mentioned. We still have best practices which we can glean from the operation of certain bodies such as WIPO and the OECD. But there's no real standard there. So I thought it was interesting to look at if we did have a standard, what would it be? And in the environmental governance regime, there's actually an instrument called the ARIS Convention, which was passed following on from an earlier declaration, the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development. And this ARIS Convention actually sets out the minimum standards of transparency and public participation for decisions made on environmental matters. And it declares that there's a right to access environmental information, there's a right to public participation in decisions with environmental impact and in plans relating to the environment and during preparation of normative instruments, and there's a right to access independent review. And I thought this was really an eye-opener for us in the context of ACTA, because to think that there's a right to public participation in the preparation of normative instruments goes completely against what we're being told by the ACTA negotiators, who say, no, it's quite normal for the public to be shut out. It's quite normal that we shouldn't release negotiating texts. It's quite normal that we should wait for the negotiating countries to agree before the public gets to have any say. And the ARIS Convention really shows that this is quite contrary to a very well-established regime of governance in the environmental sphere. And it's not just in environmental law. Also in internet governance, there was a summit held in 2003 and 2005 called the World Summit on the Information Society. And that came out with a declaration of principles about how the internet should be governed. And it said that internet governance should be multilateral, transparent and democratic, with the full involvement of governments, the private sector, civil society and international organisations. And what we're seeing in ACTA, again, is quite the opposite of that. We're seeing this as a government-centred process. There has been much more access by the private sector than by civil society or consumers, but still it's pretty much been reserved to governments. And when we consider that there's not really any difference in principle between the internet governance regime and the IP global regime, it's difficult to see why civil society shouldn't have the same rights of access, because IP laws cross national borders just as internet regulations do. So I guess the point of my paper was to say, look, we need to not just take for granted what the ACTA negotiators are saying. We need to look at best practices from the environmental governance regime and the internet governance regime, and we'll find that, yes, there is a right to access information. Yes, there is a right to public participation in decision-making. And yes, there should be full involvement of all stakeholders, not just governments, in the negotiation of these sorts of instruments. So my conclusion was not only is ACTA failing to stack up against these standards, but it even compares poorly to the other IP global institutions, such as WIPO. WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, allows free public access to accredited civil society organizations, to the meetings of its standing committees. Its negotiation texts are freely distributed on the internet without exception. The WTO, the World Trade Organization, has come in for some criticism for its lack of transparency, but compared to ACTA, you'd be surprised that it releases all its official documents online. Its ministerial conference is open to NGOs from civil society. And then when you go down to perhaps less hard law-setting organisations, it's even more open. So the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, was another case study in my paper. The Commission for Science and Technology for Development, the CSTD, was another. And the Internet Governance Forum was another case study that I looked at. And all of these organisations are extremely open compared to ACTA. In fact, the Internet Governance Forum was the organisation that I wrote my doctoral thesis about, and it's elevates civil society to a position of equality with governments. Governments and civil society talk around the same table at the IGF. Now, admittedly, the IGF doesn't have the power to make laws, and so we have to make some allowance for that. But even so, the principle is that civil society should be an equal stakeholder, or at least should be a participating stakeholder in the development of global policies in that area of governance. And I think there's a very strong argument that if it should be true for internet governance, it should be true for IP governance as well.
We're chatting with Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International on Hearsay Culture, KZSU-FM, Stanford. Jeremy, I only have a few minutes left, and I'll ask this question in the positive, although I'm not sure there is a positive answer. But is there any reason to be hopeful that we would find more transparency either in the remaining negotiations of ACTA or, as you suggest, more significantly, in the ACTA institution?
Well, there are only a few glimmers of hope, but I think if we're going to try and find some positives. One of them is that there are grumblings from the countries that have been left out of the negotiation room. And whilst the ACTA negotiators aren't very interested in listening to civil society voices, the voices of other governments are sometimes harder to ignore. So we have India putting out a very strong statement against ACTA and the exclusion of developing country interests from these negotiations. We've even had the European Parliament criticising the lack of transparency in ACTA. So I think that our best hope to overturn this process or to throw a spanner in the works is going to be through these supportive government processes. It's kind of sad to have to say that because there should be machinery in place for civil society voices to be heard against ACTA. But really, that's not in place at the moment. So we just have to, I guess, throw our support behind the governments that are supporting our civil society voices and hope that they might have better luck than we have in stopping this from being railroaded through.
It's interesting. I'm beginning to see a pattern. It seems that India comes out doing quite well as far as Consumers International is concerned with respect to IP issues generally.
Yeah, and look, I'm not suggesting that India doesn't have its own motivations. India is, for example, one of the world's leading producers of generic pharmaceuticals. And so part of its motivation is to protect its domestic manufacturers of generic pharmaceuticals. However, I do believe that many countries, and India is only one of them, do also have a much stronger voice for consumers. Partly also the Indian movie industry is not dominated by Hollywood. The Bollywood movie industry is a domestic industry in India which actually has a lot more power than Hollywood does. So the power of the conglomerates, the US-based conglomerates, is much reduced in some of these developing countries, and that's why we see some of them coming up with fairer IP regimes domestically and trying to push those regimes in international fora as well.
It's a fascinating area. Unfortunately, we've largely run out of time, although maybe this is a very unfair question. I ask these unfair questions towards the end of the show, but I'll ask it and see if you can answer it in under a minute. Why is it that Bollywood doesn't have similar concerns that Hollywood does? Are Bollywood films not being pirated the way that Hollywood films are? Or what is there a short answer to why they may have a different view with respect to these issues than Hollywood?
Well, Bollywood is changing and certainly coming around to the heavyweight US-style way of enforcing its interests. But the other thing to consider is that legitimate copies of Bollywood movies in India are only a couple of dollars. And so there's not such a gap between piracy and the legitimate product in India. And I think that's a tactic that we could learn from in the West too. If you just reduce the cost and increase the availability of materials in the formats that consumers want, online and in hard format, then the incidence of piracy is bound to be reduced over time.
Jeremy Malcolm of Consumers International, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture with what turned out to be a much more wide-ranging discussion than even I anticipated, but a great discussion nonetheless. I think we covered a lot of ground in a relatively short amount of time. For those that want to learn more about your organization, you mentioned consumersinternational.org. Are there any other websites or sources of information on these issues that you recommend?
Well, a2knetwork.org is the other one. That's the sub-site that we use for access to knowledge issues.
Excellent. Jeremy, thank you much for joining us today from your home in Kuala Lumpur. It is nighttime there, so I will thank you in short order, and I invite you back on the show to continue this discussion, perhaps lighting a fire of hope. The next time we chat, we'll be able to say more positive things about at least ACTA. But thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture over the next several weeks as the quarter continues its operations. I'm excited in particular to mention that coming up next week will be Shubha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin discussing his work on transparency issues with regard and commercialization of data. And that'll be a fun discussion that I think you'll enjoy. We'll also be chatting with Laura DeNardis of Yale's Information Society Project, discussing her book, Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance. Paul Jones from iBiblio will be on. Professor Edward Penalver and Sonia Kotyal will be on discussing their book, Property Outlaws. Professor Rob Frieden of Penn State's College of Communication will be discussing his book, Winning the Silicon Sweepstakes. Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy will be on, author of the book How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web. Associate Dean Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law will be on, discussing his work on the commons. And rounding out the quarter will be Professor Oded Shankar of Ohio State University Fisher College of Business, author of the book Copycats. I mention that there are a variety of ways to pick up Hearsay Culture. You can pick up the show by going to our website at hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up all previous shows. You can listen to the show live, the best way to listen, on KZSU FM Stanford from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also get the show by podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page at Center for Internet Society at Stanford through iTunes, or by going to our website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.